This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening music is courtesy of Joseph Martin, Professor of Music at the Lamont School of Music at Denver University. Welcome to the poetry section of the bookshelf. I've selected some poems that have inspired me and others, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to them again or for the first time. The Poetry Corner. Today I'm going to start by going back in history to ancient Roman days of over 2,000 years ago. Samuel Taylor Coleridge insisted that poetry cannot be translated, yet in defiance of him, some brilliant renderings have been created. So here follows some ancient Latin poetry as translated by some English-speaking classical poets. We may find that the ancient themes were not as ancient as we may think. The first work comes from Quintus Horatius Flaccus, better known as Horace. He was born in southeast Italy in 65 BCE and deceased in 8 BCE. This poem is entitled, Enjoy the Present Hour. Behold yon mountain's hoary height, made higher with new mounts of snow. Again behold winter weight oppress the laboring woods below, and streams with icy fetters bound be numbed and cramped to solid ground. With well-heaped logs dissolve the cold, and feed the genial hearth with fires, produce the wine that makes us bold, and love of sprightly wit inspires. For what hereafter shall be tied, God, if 'tis worth his care, provide. To him alone, with what he made, to toss and turn the world below, at his command the storms invade, the winds by his commission blow, till with a nod he bids them cease, and calm returns, and all is peace. Tomorrow and her works defy, lay hold upon the present hour, and snatch the pleasures passing by, to put them out of fortune's power. Nor love, nor love's delight disdain, whate'er thou gettest today is gain. Secure those golden early joys, that youth unsoured by sorrow bears, ere withering time and taste destroys, with sickness and unwieldy years. For active sports, for pleasing rest, this is the time to be possessed. The best is but in season best. The appointed hour is promised bliss, the pleasing whisper in the dark, the unhalf-willing, willing kiss, the laugh that guides thee to the mark. When the kind nymph would coyness feign, and hides but to be loved again, these are joys the gods for youth ordain. Translated by John Dryden, 1685. Next is Publius Ovidius Naso, better known simply as Ovid. He was born in 43 BCE in central Italy, and then moved into smart Roman society. He died about 17 CE in exile on the Black Sea, when he fell out of favor with the Emperor Augustus. We can see his sense of humor in this work entitled Advice to Women. Maidens, give ear, and you shall hear what is your chiefest duty. Pray listen well, and I will tell you how to keep your beauty. 'Tis care that makes the barren earth produce the ripened grain. 'Tis care that brings tree fruit to birth with grafting and much pain. Things that are cared for always please, and now each man's a dandy. A girl must be as spruce as he, and have her powder handy. Translated by F. A. Wright in the early 1900s. The next poet is Gaius Julius Phaedrus, better known simply as Phaedrus, who was born in Macedonia about 15 BCE as a slave. He came to Rome and was freed by the Emperor Augustus, and he died about 50 CE. He was confident of immortality as a Romanizer, with improvements, of the traditional Greek fables collectively known as Aesop. Perhaps he felt an affinity, since Aesop was also believed to be a slave at Samos some 500 years previous. The first of his works here, The Wolf and the Lamb. By thirst incited to the brook, the wolf and lamb themselves betook. The wolf high up the current drank, the lamb far lower down the bank. Then bent his ravenous maw to cram, the wolf took umbrage at the lamb. "How dare you trouble all the flood and mingle my good drink with mud?" "Sir," says the lambkin, sore afraid, "how should I act as you upbraid? The thing you mention cannot be. The stream descends from you to me." "Abashed by facts," says he, "I know. 'Tis now exact 6 months ago. You strove my honest fame to blot."
"6 months ago, sir, I was not."
"Then 'twas the old ram, thy sire," he cried, and so he tore him till he died. To those this fable I address, who are determined to oppress and trump up any false pretense, but they will injure innocence. Translated by Christopher Smart in 1765. The Fox and the Crow. Who in deceitful praise takes pleasure, his folly will repeat at leisure. Perched o'er his head, sly Reynard sees in a crow's beak a tempting cheese, when thus the cunning fox began. "O crow, more fair than any swan, if like thy form thy voice should be, what bird could be compared to thee?" To sing the flattered fool would try, the cheese came tumbling from on high. Voracious Reynard snapped it up, and laughing left his hungry dupe, who on an empty stomach rued that flattery is but hollow food. Translated by Sir Brooke Boothby, 1809. We move ahead now from ancient history to modern, Thomas Stearns Eliot. He was born in Missouri in 1888 and later moved to England and became a British subject. One of his most famous works is The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, written in 1910, but not published until 1915. The poem follows the conscious experience of a man lamenting his physical and intellectual inaction, struggling towards a love which he could not attain. The poem gives the feeling that the searcher is middle-aged, yet Eliot was only 22 when he wrote it. The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels, and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once around the house and fell asleep. And indeed there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time, there will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me. And time yet for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions, before the taking of the toast and tea. In the room the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair,
with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin. My necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all already, known them all. Have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase, and when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt-ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl, and should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. In the afternoon, the evening, sleep so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor, here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moments to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it, after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, after the porcelain, among some talk of you and me? Would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come back from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all, if one settling a pillow by our head should say, that is not what I meant at all, that is not it at all. And would it have been worth it, after all? Would it have been worthwhile after the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this, and so much more? It is impossible to say just what I mean, but as if a magic lantern threw the nerves and patterns on the screen, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. Am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince, no doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious, and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse, at times indeed almost ridiculous. Almost at times the fool. I grow old. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaid singing, each to each. I do not think they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back when the wind blows the water white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown till human voices wake us and we drown. And now, in a different vein, In the 1930s, Eliot penned a collection of whimsical poems for his godchildren entitled Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. This work was adapted by Andrew Lloyd Webber and became the hit musical Cats. From Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, Mr. Mistopheles. You ought to know Mr. Mistopheles, the original conjuring cat. There can be no doubt about that. Please listen to me and don't scoff. All his inventions are off his own bat. There is no such cat in the metropolis. He holds all the patent monopolies for performing surprising illusions and creating eccentric confusions. At prestidigitation and legerdemain, he'll defy examination and deceive you again. The greatest magicians have something to learn from Mr. Mistopheles' conjuring turn. Presto! Away we go, and we all say, Oh, well, I never. Was there ever a cat so clever as magical Mr. Mistopheles? He is quiet and small. He is black from his ears to the tip of his tail. He can creep through the tiniest crack. He can walk on the narrowest rail. He can pick any card from a pack. He is equally cunning with dice. He is always deceiving you into believing that he's only hunting for mice. He can play any trick with a cork or a spoon and a bit of fish paste. If you look for a knife or a fork and you think it is merely misplaced, you have seen it one moment and then it is gone. But you'll find it next week lying out on the lawn. And we all say, Oh, well, I never. Was there ever a cat so clever as magical Mr. Mistopheles? His manner is vague and aloof. You would think there is nobody shyer, but his voice has been heard on the roof when he was curled up by the fire. And he has sometimes been heard by the fire when he was about on the roof. At least, we all heard someone who heard, which is incontestable proof of his singular magical powers. And I have known the family to call him in from the garden for hours while he was asleep in the hall. And not long ago, this phenomenal cat produced 7 kittens right out of a hat. And we all said, Oh, well, I never. Did you ever know a cat so clever as magical Mr. Mistopheles? The American poet Robert Frost, probably best known for his poem that was read at the Kennedy inauguration, also published a work that was called The Road Not Taken in 1916. He later claimed that people took this work far more seriously than ever he had intended. Frost had spent the years 1912 to 1915 in England, and one of his acquaintances there was writer Edward Thomas, and they often took walks together. Apparently, Thomas showed a great deal of indecision about which paths to take during their outings. And so when Frost returned to New Hampshire in 1915, he wrote this poem as a gentle mocking of Thomas's habits. Even Thomas took it too seriously, and he also took it personally. And some think that this may have been the final straw in his decision to enlist in World War I. Sadly, from that decision, he was killed 2 years later in the Battle of Arras. The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps a better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that passing there had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads unto way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that made all the difference. Our next poet was born in the Los Angeles area of Southern California in 1906. Richard Armour. He received a Ph.D. in English literature from Harvard and went on to publish more than 6,000 works of poetry. Most of his works were considered humorous, but this one strikes a chord with every father and the miracle of his child, one small son. One small hand to hold in yours, one small face to smile. One wet kiss as he says goodnight, one small child. Catch the moment, put it in your heart, the years too soon will fly. These are precious moments, more than money can buy. Two small arms to hold you tight, two small feet to run. Two small eyes full of love for you, one small son. Catch the moment and put it in your heart and never let it go. Save it for the years to come when he, too, will know. One small hand to hold in his, one small face to smile. One small kiss and she says good night. One small child. Our next author is Chicago-born Shel Silverstein. The best biography of him may be one he did of himself. He said, "When I was a kid, 12 to 14, I'd much rather have been a good baseball player or a hit with the girls. But I couldn't play ball. I couldn't dance. Luckily, the girls didn't want me. So I started to draw and to write." He became a noted cartoonist, often appearing in Playboy. He was a poet with works like Light in the Attic and Where the Sidewalk Ends, and he was a songwriter. Did you know he wrote the popular Johnny Cash recording of A Boy Named Sue? Not all of his poetry was for children, as this piece called Almost Perfect. Almost perfect, but not quite. Those were the words of Mary Hume at her 7th birthday party, looking round the ribbon room. "The tablecloth is pink, not white. Almost perfect, but not quite." Almost perfect, but not quite. Those were the words of grown-up Mary talking about her handsome beau, the one she wasn't going to marry. "Squeezes me a bit too tight. Almost perfect, but not quite." Almost perfect, but not quite. Those were the words of old Miss Hume, teaching in the 7th grade, grading papers in the gloom, late at night up in her room. "They never cross their T's just right. Almost perfect, but not quite." 98 the day she died, complaining about the spotless floor. People shook their heads and sighed, guess that she'll like heaven more. Up went her soul on feathered wings, out the door, up out of sight. Another voice from heaven came, almost perfect, but not quite. A genre of poetry that became popular in the American West was cowboy poetry. Cowboying was a hard life, both for the man and for his family. It wasn't always pretty, but it was a life that was a part of the nation and had a ring of a real Americana in it. One example is from Ozark Ray's John Roberts Svensson, better known as Jim Fish. Here is a story of what's important at the end of the road. Hard times. When hard times come, they sit a spell like kinfolk come to stay. A pack of troubles, pets and kids, they always get in your way. It's drought and flood and drought. There ain't much in between. You work like hell to make 'em good, but still, they're sort of lean. The ranch went under late last year. That drought got mighty tough. The boss held out a long, long time, but finally said, enough. So here I am dispatching cops and watching felons sleep. Injunction at the county jail. A job I'll probably keep. The wife, she works at the Leisure Lodge where older people stay, a-making beds and mopping floors to earn some extra pay. Though extra pay's the term I use, it goes to paying rent. And after all the bills are paid, we wonder where it went. We hawk my saddle, guns and chaps, and then our wedding rings. And when we couldn't pay the loan, they sold the damn blame things. We felt real bad a day or two, but then we let it go, 'cause it got Christmas for the kids, when money got real slow. When hard times come, they set a spell, no matter who you are. They'll cost you things you've set aside and clean your cookie jar. You'll lose some sleep and worry some, won't pay to moan and groan. But hang on to your happiness. They'll finally leave you alone. While we're dealing with Americana, not all the poets who catch the spirit of the times are famous poets. One example is an author that was published in the Western Humanities Review in the winter of 1965. Mother's Biscuits by Frida Quenneville. In a big bowl she'd fluff and flour, make a fist dent for buttermilk and lard, which she squeezed between her fingers, the way a child goes at a mud puddle, raking dry flour from the sides until it's mixed right. She'd give the dough a pat for luck, dip a springy bud, roll it round and flat it down, with a motion continued to grease shine pan. Mother's biscuits, cooked high, crusty, with succulent middles that took attention at company dinners, but on kitchen nights they were finest, soaked with pot liquor or gravy. And those rich biscuits could put a shine on Sunday patent and let the Lord know who was there. A panful stood ready as magic at dawn's light. I'd take some when leaving late to the school bus, and up the road I'd run, puffing through biscuit crumbs, my haloed breath into the skin-sharp morning air. Our final poet today is Jenny Joseph, born in 1932 in England, her most famous work being Warning, written in 1961. This poem was named by the BBC as the most popular poem of the post-war period, and it became the inspiration of the Red Hat Society. You might not recognize the poem from the title, Warning, but you soon will as soon as it starts to be read. When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple with a red hat which doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals and say we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bills and run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick the flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausage at a go, or only bread and pickle for a week, and hoard pens and pencils and beer mats and things in boxes. But now we must have clothes that keep us dry, and pay our rent and not swear in the street, and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I should practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Thanks for listening in to this special part of the bookshelf, the Poetry Corner. If you have enjoyed this feature and would like to hear more, please call us at 919-832-5138. And if you have a favorite that you'd like to hear, do call and tell us about your favorite poetry. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Until next time.